Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Labor Day, the unofficial start of fall, is almost here. And when you think about it, Labor Day is almost like a mini version of New Year's Day, a time for new beginnings. As you prepare to get back down to business and to your busy fall lifestyle, wouldn't it be a great time to make a resolution or two? Why don't you resolve right now to break at least one bad habit? And you protest that you don't have any bad habits? Come on, everyone on this planet has at least one bad habit, and lots of us have several, myself included. Snacking, shopping for what we don't really need, ladies, listen to that. Excessive partying, messiness, procrastination, swearing. Then there are the more serious harmful behaviors. Excessive gambling, shoplifting, lying, pornography, sexual addiction, and of course substance abuse, tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, and the serious stuff like heroin, cocaine, and meth. Now, you and I, indeed most people of middle age, are not stupid. So if we know a habit is bad, harmful to us, and perhaps also to those we love, why don't we just stop doing it? Well, if you've ever tried to break a bad habit like I have, and I'm certain you know, it's a lot easier said than done, and that's why so many of us make and break the same New Year's resolutions year after year. But here's some good news. My guest today, Scott Spackey, an international addiction expert, is here to coach us on breaking bad habits. In fact, later on in the show, in 2 minutes, he'll teach anyone, including you and me, how to break their bad habit. But for the next few minutes, I suggest think about one or two bad habits that you would most like to eliminate once and for all. And Scott will also talk about our countries in the world's drug abuse crisis and why current treatment methods so often fail and how they can be improved. And Scott Spackey is a California State Certified Addiction Treatment Counselor and a Registered Addiction Specialist. He's served as a private practice counselor since 2006 and mentors and trains other addiction counselors. And he's also a certified life coach and a certified clinical hypnotherapist specializing in crisis counseling. He's author of 3 books, including the one we'll talk about today, Project Addiction, The Complete Guide to Using, Abusing, and Recovering from Drugs and Behaviors. And he has hands-on experience because he started on pot at age 13, regularly dosing on LSD by 15, and shooting up heroin, cocaine, and meth at 17. And he was involved in a notorious L.A. organized counterfeit and meth ring in the 90s. Most of his former associates are either dead in prison or still on drugs, but somehow Scott survived and has now been clean for over 20 years. And congratulations, Scott, on your recovery, and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Well, thank you for the congratulations, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Well, let's begin with the obvious question. If we know a habit is bad and we want to quit, why can't we just stop doing it? Why isn't our willpower strong enough to make us stop?
That is the obvious question. It's a very good question. And the reality is, because by the time we realize we have a habit, it's been there a long time. So we've been kind of conditioning and creating it for a long time. So by the time we're consciously aware that we have a bad habit, it's been there a long time. And every day that it's there, it gets stronger and it lays a bigger and deeper foundation. So what we instinctively do is we try to use our willpower, our strength, to overpower it. And all that does... Listen, it's kind of like this. If you and I are sitting in the same room and we're not pushing each other, the reason for that is because neither one of us is pushing or aggravating it. But if I get up and push you, what are you going to do?
You're going to push back.
That's right. That's a natural reaction. That's not aggressive. That's not violent. That's just a natural reaction. So when we try to outpower and push our bad habits, they push back proportionately. So the more we try to push them, the more they push back. So instead of trying to overpower them, what I teach people is how to outsmart them. We don't overpower it. Let's face it, a bad habit is dumb. It doesn't even have a mind. So we can figure out a strategy to outsmart it, and that's what I teach people to do.
I see. Well, we may become addicted to any number of habits, behaviors, or substances, and people often refer to addiction as disease. In fact, is addiction a disease and something that can be cured?
That is a great question, and that's a great way to put it. Absolutely not. A disease is many diseases can be cured, and a disorder cannot. Addiction is a disorder, like ADD and OCD and many mental and emotional afflictions. It's a disorder, not a disease. A disease is something of the body. A disorder is something of the mind and spirit and emotion.
Yeah, I guess that's why at AA meetings, attendees always introduce themselves as John Smith or whatever. I am an alcoholic, because I guess you never really recover from this pathological disorder, but you can maintain and overcome it, I guess, is what the strategy is.
That's correct. I'm living proof. I mean, I've been clean for 22 years. I'm still an addict. I have tendencies that non-addicts just don't have. But I've learned to manage it. And you could say that mine's in more of a remission state instead of remission. And it's dormant. So it's still there, but it's not active.
Yeah, I'm a cancer survivor. And my cancer hopefully is permanently in remission. But I need to manage it, obviously, to make sure it stays that way. Well, what are three reasons why using the term disease to addiction is so harmful?
Well, I think it is a convenient label for the non-addict world to use because it gives them less accountability. Somebody has a disease and there's this subconscious response to, well, you know, it's beyond my control. We can care about it. We can get involved a little bit, but we can't expect too much. It's also dangerous for the addicts themselves because they also get desensitized. They get a subconscious perception that this is hopeless. This is beyond my control.
Yeah,
so why bother
anytime you assign something to someone else's control or it's beyond, you know, if only I didn't have this, or, you know, you just basically resign yourselves that it's something you can't control, then you don't take steps to address it. I think that's a very good point. But well, from your experience as an addiction counselor, what is the toughest behavior to treat and why?
Well, I'll tell you, they all vary on magnitude, but honestly, it's not necessarily the particular drug or behavior. It has to do with the personality and how long a behavior has been there and the intensity of it for that personality. So I've treated people with severe heroin addictions that was much easier than treating people with a shopping addiction and vice versa. So it really isn't about the behavior itself. It's about the magnitude to that particular personality.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's why you say it's so individualized. It is,
and also the method that has to be taught and worked with a client has to be absolutely customized to that person, not only just to the behavior itself. We can't treat heroin like meth or coke or shopping. They have to be treated very specifically, and it has to be very customized to the personality. We're all different. Different people are drawn to different things, and so we have to be able to devise a strategy that will work for them, not just something that works in general, but something that is particularly customized just for them, their personality, they're not only their strengths, but their weaknesses too. If somebody comes to me to lose weight, and I say, well, I'll tell you what you do, stop eating so much and run a lot. Easier said than done. They'd look at me and say, duh, you know, I didn't come to you for that. And so I have to break down. That one of their weaknesses is that they don't have self-control in the same way that they hope to have, and they don't have the kind of stamina. And so we have to kind of strategically ease them into these new behaviors. So one of the ways that I teach people how to so-called break a bad habit is really by replacing it with a good one. With the exact same formula that our mind creates a bad habit, it will create a good habit through repetition and association. The exact same formula used in an opposite direction with a different objective.
Well, in your promotion, you promise in 2 minutes you can teach anyone to break their bad habit, and I trust each listener has chosen at least one bad habit they want to break, so please get to it.
Okay. Going at me.
Okay, well, let's say I want to
stop
smoking.
Or shall I give you one that I heard recently?
Yeah, that's fine. You give me.
I've got two that I just heard recently. One of them was an energy drink. A guy called on a radio show that I was on, and he said, you know, I have a real problem with energy drinks, and they're not that healthy. They're really bad for me. How do I stop? So that one was fairly simple. I did this in about 35 seconds. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to take the exact amount of quantity that you have of energy drinks, and every time you open one, I want you to pour half of it out and continue to drink the other half. Do not stop cold turkey. Your mind will resist that. So instead, I want you to gradually stop. So for 1 week, I want you to pour half of it out of every container that you open. Go ahead and drink half, but, and don't just drink half and set the other part aside. The moment you open it, pour half it out. It symbolizes something to our subconscious mind that we're taking control, and that has power.
Great.
And then, of course, we're also reducing the quantity. We're easing our way into this new behavior and away from this bad behavior.
Yeah.
The second one that I was called recently about had to do with biting your nails. That's a very, very common one. You know, you'd be surprised how often I get people calling me and asking me to teach them how to stop biting their nails.
I do that this sometimes one, myself.
That's right. Don't we all? You know, and this, but you know, when it's chronic, it can be a real problem. We bite down to the nub. So that one's a little bit more complicated. And this especially works better for men, and you'll hear why. So what I explained to this person was, I said, all right, every morning, I want you to get up and I want you to set aside 15 minutes, which let's face it, when we get up in the morning, we don't have spare time. None of us do. We're all busy. So you have to get up a little bit earlier and I want you to spare 15 to 20 minutes to paint your nails. And this guy was a man. He said, paint my nails. I mean, I don't paint my nails. I said, I know you don't. And that's why every morning when you're doing this, you're going to be very conscious of why you're actually doing this. And you're going to feel very, very upset about thinking, oh, my God, I have to do this because I am so dumb I can't stop biting my nails. And I want you to paint them a color you can't stand. Now when you walk around all day and every motion you have, you're going to see this and you're going to be reminded as to why you've done this. And it's going to help you. And when you go to put them in your mouth, you will not be able to do it unconsciously and being unaware. You will do it and you will see it each and every time. And so when you're aware of it, now you have some control. Now you can discipline yourself to stop. The problem with a habit is that it works unconsciously. We do it. We don't even know we're doing it. So when those nails are painted green or bright pink, you'll see it. You'll be very consciously aware. And then,
if you're a man, you'll be hiding your hands all day so somebody else can see it.
That's right. And so you become very consciously aware of the actual behavior. And then I said to this gentleman, so at night, every night, before you go to bed, I want you to get out the nail polish remover and clean those nails clean. It'll be annoying. It'll be smelly. It's a horrible chore. And so every morning you got to paint them, and every night you got to take it off.
Only to go through it all again the next day. That would be.
That's right. And so eventually, within a week and a half, this guy was saying to me, "You know what? I got so sick of doing it. I figured it was easier to stop biting my nails than to do this. So I just got so sick of it, I just stopped."
Of course, most of my friends now think I'm weird for painting my fingernails.
Exactly, and that was kind of the point. We want to create a very, very consciously aware negative association with the behavior itself. I taught a man once how to stop smoking. I've done a lot of that. I have a very high success rate of doing that. And this man came in. It's a 6-week program that I have for quitting smoking, and it works every time. And this man came in his third week and threw a pack of cigarettes in me. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "You know what? I quit. I'm so sick of this. I'm so sick of what you're making me do this. I just quit now. I don't want to go through another."
I was in a program years ago, and they made us smoke Carlton cigarettes the last couple of weeks. I don't know if you've ever heard of Carlton cigarettes. They have no taste whatsoever.
And that's one of the things I do, is I have people switch to a brand that is absolutely so offensive. So, in other words, so people that would normally smoke a Carlton or a Camel non-filter, I have them switch to a menthol.
Oh,
now, people, if you've ever smoked, which I used to a long time ago, I mean, I would never touch a menthol. So I'd have them smoke a menthol for a week, and then I had this other whole part of this process, which is posted up on my website by popular demand. My publisher said, "Scott, don't put the non-smoking thing up on your website. People need to buy your book." I said, "Yeah, I know, but it's what people really want." So I went ahead and put it up on the website.
Well, let's turn our attention to the critical challenge of battling drug addiction in our country and worldwide. I know you personally overcame severe addiction and involvement with gangs in the 90s. Was there one specific event or a series of events that triggered your desire to get straight and overcome your drug habits? And where did you turn for help in getting started?
Well, you know, the second part of your question, where did I turn for help? I had absolutely zero resources. I had no money.
Yeah.
I had nothing access to, and so I had to do what we call white knuckling. And I outline in my book how, if you have to do it alone, how you can do that successfully and how I did it. It is the hardest, most Herculean thing that anyone can ever do. So I don't recommend it. However, it is an option. And me, I didn't have any other options. I had no choice but to do it on my own because I had no access to nothing else. the few programs that were available for free that I had access to didn't fit for me. I'm not saying that they're bad. They're perfectly fine. They just didn't work for me. I mean, it's kind of like I like cold weather. I don't like hot weather. There's nothing wrong with hot weather. I just personally, it doesn't resonate with me. So I have to find something that's actually going to resonate with us. Now, I'm sorry. What was the first part of your question? I'm sorry.
Well, I was just wondering if there was one specific event that triggered you to overcome that addiction.
It absolutely was. My son was just born, and he was 8 months old, and I was still on drugs.
That's a great reason.
And I had a moment where I was, like, changing his diaper and kind of goofing off with him. We were playing a little bit, and I had this all of a sudden instant, that moment of clarity that they talk about, this absolute objective realization. I saw myself how he would see me if he was cognizant and aware and older and mature.
Oh, wow.
And in that moment, I saw myself for what I really was, not a guy who went to work and had a kid and had a drug problem. No, I was a guy who had a drug problem, and I prioritized that over each and everything. And so I saw myself for once how I actually really was, without any softening of the edges about it. And in that moment, I was completely devastated, and I wanted to die. I didn't want to just die. I wanted to have never have existed at all.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful that you had that and were able to to do it. What's that you call it where you do it all by yourself? White knuckle.
I call it white knuckling, yes.
Yeah.
In my book, I have a chapter that's called Solo Recovery. So if nothing else, if nothing is accessible to you, there's a whole book teaching you each and every method that's available out there and several that I've pioneered on my own.
Oh, that's great. Well, when addiction is severe and negatively impacts quality of life, perhaps threatens your health and well-being, even survival of self and others, we are encouraged and often court-mandated to enter a rehab and recovering facility. But you report these facilities have a lower than 10% success rate while they earn billions of dollars. Why are they so unsuccessful?
The reason is it has so much to do with the bottom line. We're talking about a group of facilities that are primarily run by well-trained, educated clinicians, and that is good, but they don't have the actual experience of actually dealing with it themselves. And so clinicians are smart, but what they should be doing is working along with a lot of addicts who can consult and put into the programs so that they, again, can customize it. So one of the things that I point out very emphatically in my book is that when somebody goes into a rehab or residential or any type of program, they're expected to adapt to the program, not the other way around. And what I teach in my book is I teach how to get the program to adapt to you. Because it's not about you adapting to the program. It's about getting that program to adapt to you. And there are ways to do that. And I teach people to do it all the time.
Oh, I see. Yeah, given that dismal 10% recovery rate for rehab facilities, where should a drug or alcohol addicted individual turn for coverage? Are you saying that we should avoid the facilities like that, or like you say, I guess if you get them to work for you, it would work.
And no, I'm not suggesting that they avoid them. I'm suggesting that, you know, it's why I created this book, because inside that book is the absolute details as to exactly what is wrong with them and why and how to make them work for you. So with each and every program, we have to find the one that's going to fit with us. So that's one of the reasons I included that entire section in the book that breaks down each and every treatment method that's available in the world today. And I describe it in detail. So we can not only learn about it, but again, we can see what's wrong with it and we can see what could be better about it. But more importantly, we can see how to extract what can be good out of it, how to make it work for us. Every program does have some very beneficial traits and some features that can definitely help us, but we have to be very smart and resourceful and figure out a way to organize those things and structure them. And sometimes it's about hybridizing. I have clients that are involved with one or two different programs, and they see me. And what I do is I help them get the most out of the other programs that they're involved with.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you don't have to stick just to one program necessarily.
When you have a medical issue, you said you had some cancer issues. I mean, you didn't have just one doctor that managed everything. You had different specialists dealing with different areas.
Yeah,
thankfully, you know.
Well, let's say a family member, a spouse, son or daughter, whoever is addicted, and we want desperately to help them recover. We want to become an effective, what you call an RS, a recovery supporter. How can we support properly so that we don't hinder recovery And you mentioned that some people are disqualified from the RS role, and why?
Yes, absolutely. The people that are disqualified are people that have pathologies of their own, such as addiction.
Oh, I see.
I mean, clearly, we don't want to have somebody who's involved with drugs and addiction who's counseling us or advising us or supporting us. It's not that they don't mean well. It's just that they're not qualified at that time in their life. And also, people that have other severe pathologies currently. So, if somebody's going through some of a crisis of their own, they need to deal with that. So they can't handle the extra burden. So we have to be very careful because they can make the situation worse. So one of the main things that I point out in the RS, Recovery Supporters, section of the book, teaching people how to fill this role, is so much important, so much even more importantly, what to do is what not to do. Not just how to react to things, but how not to react to keep them from getting worse.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Well, let's talk a bit about your acclaimed 2015 book, Project Addiction, The Complete Guide to Using, Abusing, and Recovering from Drugs and Behaviors. How is your book different from all the other addiction recovery books out there?
That's another good question. Thank you for asking it. It can be a little uncomfortable sometimes because my book, the way that I describe things as a veteran drug addict and drug user, what I call myself as a dope fiend, is that the drug descriptions in my book, each drug out there and each behavior has its own separate individual chapter. And these chapters explain these drugs in visceral, intense, graphic detail. In other words, if you haven't ever done them, you virtually will be when you read the descriptions of how I'm describing them. Because I'm not just describing them from a clinical point of view. I'm describing them from an emotional point of view, what it's actually like to be on them, not in some dry clinical way at all. And then there's also these separate chapters for each and every treatment that's out there in the world today. So a separate chapter for each and every drug, a separate chapter for each and every treatment, and there's the entire first part of the book breaks down the addiction pathology itself chemically, mentally, emotionally, and even spiritually. So it addresses.
So it's almost like an encyclopedia then, or these medical journals you get. You have all these different drugs described, and you wouldn't have to necessarily read the whole book then if you wanted to concentrate on one particular drug that you're addicted to.
You absolutely can selectively pick certain areas, but it's definitely much more comprehensive because each section you read, even if it has nothing directly to do with your particular behavior, each one enhances the other. I mean, the entire book is a comprehensive treatment.
Well, in your book, you describe in graphic detail how specific drugs make you feel, what they cost, and how to obtain them. How do you answer critics who say you may be enlisting or enticing vulnerable individuals to try new drugs?
Well, my answer to them, which I think it's a justified criticism and concern, and I had the concern myself, too. And when I was confronted with that concern when I was writing the book, I thought to myself, well, what do? Edit it and hold back, or just put the truth out there, put it all out there, and let people need, so that I feel that the truth makes us free.
Yeah.
Knowledge is power. And so, therefore, I put all of the information there, not just so we can do what we want, but obviously there is a very consistent, strong theme to the whole thing, as any drug starts out with a lot of pleasure and enjoyment, and then eventually it turns very south and very sour and very dark, and that's exactly what these chapters do. They do describe exactly how wonderful they are, but by the time you finish that chapter, you're in a very dark place yourself just reading about them, because points out how it really is.
I would hope nobody would buy the book and just read the part about starting out and how good it makes you feel without reaching the conclusion.
Sure, and that's one of the reasons that one of the first pages of the book is a warning, reminding people to read the entire sections in a single setting, and if they can, if they're feeling triggered or cued to a using episode, they might want to have somebody else read it to them. And that's one of the reasons it's not only in a print version, but also an ebook and also in audio, because there's a lot of clients that I've had. There's a lot of people in the world that have contacted me and said, thank God for that audio version, because I really wasn't able to like read through all that stuff, but just listening to somebody tell me it was so much better.
So do you recommend people sample certain drugs in a so-called safe way? And why or why not?
Well, I absolutely don't recommend it. What I do is I I tell people how, if they're going to do it, how you can do it in a safe way.
I absolutely
discourage it, and I'm always, throughout the entire book, advising people not to and telling them how they can experience the exact same thing they're looking for, pleasure, fulfillment, mysticism, whatever it might be, in other more organic, more natural, more fulfilling ways.
Yeah.
But
that's wonderful.
I know that there are a lot of people that are going to do these things either way. And so if they are, I'm trying to help them find ways to do that safely and smartly. I'm certainly not advocating it whatsoever.
No. Well, where's the best place for listeners to go to preview and purchase your book, Project Addiction?
Well, I'd say the first stop would be to go to the website, projectaddiction.com.
Oh, okay.
And from there, there's links there to buy any of the books that I have, all three of them. And the book is available anywhere that you buy a book, Barnes & Noble, mostly online, but then some stores too. It's different town to town which store it might be in as far as a physical copy. But anywhere that you buy books online, I like Amazon, so I mean, I still think they're very tried and trusted and true. And what I like about Amazon is they have the audio version available, but it's about to become available in a whole lot of other places as well in the audio version.
Oh,
I just struck a whole new arrangement with a distributor that's going to make the audio version available across the board, not just one or two markets.
Well,
so anywhere that somebody buys a book, and I would say start with the website. Go to the website. There's a whole bunch of free stuff there. I got videos of the chapters that I've read that's on camera. I've got audio chapters. I mean, I'd say a third of the book is up on the website for free.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's projectaddiction.com is your website, right?
Correct.
And I know you also offer guidance there for a listener who would like to become a private practice addiction counselor. I guess you have a course or a series of steps they can take to become a counselor themselves on that.
I do. The follow-up book with it is Project Addiction Counselor. And it doesn't teach you just how to be a good counselor. I would say use the Project Addiction book. But the Project Addiction Counselor book teaches somebody how to go into the business and to be able to make it a profession and be able to be lucrative and be able to do it profitably and smartly without risking anything. So again,
that's great.
One of the greatest compliments I had was somebody that called me and asked me to consult with me about going into private practice for herself as a counselor. And by the time she met me, so we agreed to make an appointment. We made an appointment about a week later. And I said, you know, I'll be ready, you know, come with all your questions and, you know, try to have it all kind of ready to go. I want to make sure your time is well used. She showed up a week later and she said, you know, I had all these questions, but I kept reading your book and I don't have any anymore because your book answered them all. Everything that I need to know is actually in the book.
Oh, great.
And that's kind of how Project Addiction is as well. I'm a rather thorough person because so much is at stake when we're talking about these issues.
No, they certainly are. Well, in conclusion, statistics demonstrate that approximately 23 million Americans, 230 million worldwide, have serious addiction issues. And Scott Spackey personally estimates that well over 40% of us, all the people, have some form of excessive behaviors or bad habit issues that they want to treat and solve. And if you don't suffer from a serious form of drug or behavior addiction, you may have a son or daughter, loved one, or even spouse or dear friend who does. Or maybe you're simply concerned about the horrendous drug addiction problem in our country and throughout the world and the violent crime that so often goes along with it. Whatever your concern, I highly recommend you preview and purchase Scott Spackey's book, Project Addiction. And thank you so much for Scott, and congratulations again on your sobriety, and best of success in getting your message out.
Well, thank you so much. These were great questions, and it was a pleasure to be able to answer them.
It's always a pleasure to have guests that deal with a very difficult topic like you do on our program. Thank you so much.
Well, I can say the same thing to you about a host that's willing to deal with and confront some rather serious issues. That's sometimes a little bit too rare, so thank you.
Thank you. Like me, do you sometimes fantasize about winning a multi-million dollar lottery jackpot, then kicking back for a life of ease? Well, guess what? I believe that you and I are fortunate that we have never won such a prize. After all, the good life most prized is the one we have earned through our own ambition and hard work, or smartness, rather than something won or inherited. I further contend that you can have a vocation where you excel, enjoy your time on the job, and actually have someone pay you to have a good time. What if you could look forward to waking up each workday morning? Wouldn't that be great? Well, my free Middle Age Renewal Training mini course includes a guide to establishing your very own lottery winner's mentality. We do so by taking a mental vacation from the stress of the job we have now, thinking about ideally how you would like to spend the rest of your productive years and how you can get somebody to pay you to do that. And that's a free gift to you, that Middle Age Renewal Training mini course. The mini course also includes our Happiness Gauge Worksheet. That will help you judge how happy you are today, how far you are from the ideal life that you would like to be leading, and it will therefore set kind of a guideline of where you want to tell you how far you have to go to get to that life of your dreams. And you can download the mini course. To do so, just go to our website, middleagerenewal.com, and you can download it instantly on that website. Yes, indeed, you can win the lottery jackpot, emotionally, that is. Maybe, you know, there's a one in about 200 million chance you could actually win it, but there's a 100% chance you can win it emotionally if you follow through on our instructions. And you can take control of your future, and without doubt, over time, you will accomplish every single second half objective that truly matters to you. But first, you need to know really what those objectives are, don't you? And that's part of the process. You know, with diligent planning, along with strong support from close friends and loved ones, and wouldn't it be great to renew together with someone you love, you can accomplish a lifelong lottery winner's mentality without winning a dime. And if at some point you really do win the Powerball jackpot, that will just be icing on the cake. And thanks for joining us today on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. Tune in next week when our guest will tell us how to turn a difficult co-workers, those people you always have trouble getting along with, how you can turn them into a good day on the job. And believe me, it is possible. We'll see you next week on Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.